a little bit about this man who was quite wealthy. It was an afternoon. He was staring out of the window of his what I called quasi-palatial home. And he was looking out that window at this enormous, big, beautiful lawn that he had. And he was looking way out to the far edge of the lawn where he hired two workmen. These guys were out there. They were clearing bush and brush because he wanted to extend that lawn out even further. So they're working away, and he's just standing there watching what they're doing when his wife enters in. And she said to him, "Dear, I hate to interrupt your thoughts, but the clown we contracted to entertain at our daughter's birthday party has not arrived. And we don't have any entertainment for the children." And one smart woman, watch this next statement. "I know you'll have a solution, because you always do." And she just walked out of the room, left him staring out the window. So he's still looking out the window, and then suddenly out of the brush comes one of these guys kind of darting across his lawn, and the guy's doing cartwheels, boing and boing and boing. He keeps spinning, and a handstand and then another one, and he's nearly out of sight. And the guy is watching them as he's looking out there. The other workman had moved in to start mowing his lawn, and he yelled out to this other workman, "Wow, he's really good." And he asked him, "Does he devote a lot of time to practicing doing that?" The other workman yelled back to him, "No. In fact, I've never seen him do it before." And so the guy yells back to the workman, "Hey, would your friend do those things on the front lawn for $500 for my daughter's birthday party?" Coming up with a solution. And the guy yelled back, "Hey, Joe, for $500, would you cut off another toe?" I use him for an illustration because it shows, you can do things that you might think are impossible. I mean, things that you have never done before, if you're willing to pay the price. If you're willing to pay the price, you can do a whole lot of things that you never thought you had the capacity to do. And I say this to you because we've heard a lot this week, and this class is done long before I get to hear yesterday's news and today. We've heard a lot about sacrifice the last couple of days, that of John McCain. I respected John McCain. Didn't always agree with everything John McCain did, but I appreciate his service to the country. But as I listen to the things about sacrifice today, he sacrificed a lot. He really did. And I'm going to draw some comparisons to some of the things I heard as I close this morning about that sacrifice. But I'm going to look at another sacrifice this morning, that of King David. One that he had to make. And this exact sacrifice that David had to do with fulfilling a desire. He had an incredibly intense desire. He earnestly, probably at this point in his life, above any other thing that he could have done. I really don't believe there's anything else David wanted to do more at this point of life than to build a house or a temple for the Lord God. We read in the 69th Psalm, and this we've already established, it's David speaking. Don't care what the scholars or liberals say, this is David talking when he says, "The zeal of thine house hath eaten thee up." It was an all-consuming thing for David. It was, I call it an all-consuming fire that David had to build this house for the Lord. Now, I'm looking at David's zeal in relationship to a larger study, and that's why, which I had no clue when I started this, and that's why I apologize to you. So I don't have a book that says zeal of God compared to human emotion. That doesn't exist. Not someplace I can go look. I have a series of passages that I've had for a long time thrown aside. And when I got to the zeal in Revelation, I thought, well, this shouldn't take too long. I should have known better. Until I started looking at it. And so that's why you have these separate set of notes that I pulled out, that great big stack, so that you can have at least all this information on zeal when it's done will be consolidated in one place. And when I finish that, I'm going to go back and consolidate all the information, because I'm not still yet quite finished with dealing with this thing of confession. So you'll have it together. Then I'm going to go back to the Gospel of John, and I will not leave the Gospel again. Period. I'll teach it. It will break my heart, but I will teach it by paragraph. The reason it breaks my heart, because quite frankly, there's not a person in this room, not one of you, that are not capable of taking, reading that gospel and reading it slow enough that you can understand anything by paragraph. I've listened to enough Bible teachers on radio. I know pretty much what they do is they read the paragraph, then they tell you what they read. Hello? Why? That's... So I find that insulting to me personally. It's like listening to talking heads on TV. You know, you hear somebody give a speech. I heard what he had to say. I don't need to tell me what he had to say. I can digest for myself. But that is what I'm going to do, because I settled and teach the Gospel of John, and I have it. I really have taught the doctrines that I've seen flow out from that gospel. So I'm going to finish, because I've got those two hanging doctrines, I'm going to finish those, and then we'll go through the Gospel of John. I'll break it down into a number of paragraphs or verses, and I'll set a time limit to force myself to stay in the box. But I want to finish this thing I'm doing with zeal. I think it's important. So I think differently. When God tells me that He wants me to be zealous, I really want to know what that means. That's where I get into trouble. That's what takes me so long. I honestly want to understand when you say something to me, well, what do you mean? You tell me to homologeo my sins. Same to say, no, that's not what you really mean. Really? No, it's only a part of what you really mean. Well, how do I know? It's been a long time trying to understand that years ago. It's important to me personally, because I'm supposed to put these things into my life. But I'm not going to do that once I get past. So that's why you got this big, thick thing on zeal. I'm going to keep adding to it until I'm done. And this morning, there's an aspect of David's zeal that is this important to us. And I hope as we walk through him thus far, you can see, wow, there's a whole lot in here that has direct application for me as a believer. And so does this all-consuming zeal at this point. We read in the 132nd Psalm, Lord, remember David and all his afflictions. Please keep that one in your mind. A little later, I'll come back. How he swore unto the Lord, and he vowed unto the mighty God of Jacob, surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house, nor go up into my bed. Verse 4, I will not give sleep to mine eyes, or slumber to mine eyelids, until I found out a place for the Lord, and habitation or dwelling, probably would be a better word, a dwelling for the mighty God of Jacob. Psalm 132 at verse 4. So it's clear that this is an all-consuming. We looked at those passages in detail, so you've got some sense that this hyperbolic language is talking about an all-consuming desire. And he's got this great desire, and then he runs right into a brick wall. Go tell David my servant, thus saith the Lord, thou shalt not build me a house to dwell in. Now, here's where I can see a marked difference between emotional human enthusiasm and biblical zeal. Because when emotional human enthusiasm runs to that brick wall and it picks itself back up, it goes on about its business. Not biblical zeal. Biblical zeal is going to either run through that wall or it's going to climb over that wall. And this is exactly what we see with David. His zeal did not diminish. That's not the normal human emotional response when you tell a human being, you can't do that. That's not going to get to happen for you. But David's is not manifesting human emotional desire. He is manifesting genuine biblical zeal. And we can see this into things. No, you can't build a temple. But watch what he was involved with. Anything that God allowed him to be involved with, he jumped at it wholeheartedly. He participated in the planning of the temple, as we have covered. 1 Chronicles 28:11-19. He also procured the place for the temple. God gave him that privilege. Here's the things you can do. He didn't sit and sulk over the corner and suck his thumb and feel sorry for himself because he can't do what I want to do. I can't do nothing to you. He didn't give the raspberries. He undertook what he was able to undertake that God said, here, you can do these things. What's the temple called today, by the way? It's called Solomon's Temple. Not David. No glory for David, was there? No glory. Another difference between emotional human enthusiasm and biblical zeal. Emotional human enthusiasm does things so I can get the glory. I can get the honor. People can see me. Not biblical zeal. It's to honor the Lord. He was given the privilege. What a privilege. You get to hire the workers. Yet, any of those of you who have ever been involved with finding people to work, that's not a fun job. A lot of work. And it's, materials, I told you, I won't go to Home Depot. Period. Almost under any circumstances. My wife nearly has to threaten to divorce me before I'll even go up and go help. I hate the place. Hate it. I don't shop for materials. Find some flunky. And I do, and in my store, I told you, I'll do anything, almost anything you ask me to do. But when it comes to going to get the materials, something you need, here you go. I'm the boss. You get to go. You get to go. Okay? It's the only time I pull rank. But David did it. Some meaningless. He jumped in the truck, drove to Home Depot, got the stuff, and brought it back. A lot of fun. Now, this morning, I'm not going to get very far with this, because this needs some real understanding this weekend, next. So we can, next week we'll be dealing with a lot of criticism of our Bibles. David provided funding for the building of the temple. And if you'd like to follow, start at 1 Chronicles chapter 22 and verse 14. And I won't get too far in 22:14 because we've got to deal with the very first part of the verse before I can get to all the places where people want to attack your Bibles. And I want you to be prepared to tell them to you. Okay. Point one, and it's as far as I'm going to go this morning, David paid a personal price. And that price wasn't I'll just use the term money, though we'll see that he gave things that you might not necessarily call money, all money. But David paid a price for everything that he donated. Everything that he gave for the building of the temple cost him a personal price. And I don't mean that he lowered his balance sheet or that he had to drain out of his checking account X dollars. I'm talking about personal. That he himself personally had to experience. The verse reads, "Now, behold," now King James, that's what I'm reading from now, at this moment, "in my trouble." I think some of the newer texts say, "with great pains," something of that nature. "I have prepared for the house of the Lord." And that's as far as I'm going to get today. And then we'll next week look at the 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver and bronze and iron beyond weight, for it is in abundance, timber also, and stone I prepared, and thou mayest add to this, or you'll probably have to add to this as a thought. But I want us to look at these words here this morning. "Now behold, in my trouble." Now behold, with great pains. Those words, "in my trouble," "with great pains," are the translation of two Hebrew words. I don't have the preposition "the" on the front of it. That's where they're getting, "well, I've just got great pains or my trouble." And that's coming, that's correct, from the word "ani." Now, that's the translators have taken that word "ani." King James says "my trouble." New American Standard, and again, I think most of the rest of my read, had something to do with pains, with the word. The reason we're going to take time to look at it is because I'm told to. Did you see the first two words? "Now behold." The word "behold," hine, is an interjection, just like in English, they're meant to get your attention. They're attention grabbers. It's an interjection demanding attention. So the Holy Spirit has told me it's one of the things I like when you're going through the Scripture. I feel sorry for these guys that got to find these sermons out of the air, out of pop psychology and all this. At least I know what to do. I'm told. I want you to pay attention to what I'm about to tell you, Carl. This is a non-optional thing for you. Behold. And then, okay, well, I'll look. Look at this. And so, hold on. Look at this. And what we're going to look at are these words, in my trouble, with great pain. And now I have the preposition, beth. That's this little word here. And this is, and he, as it's put here. And this is the personal pronoun that they pick up. Me, my, I. Literally, it means I. You could translate it in. I wouldn't. I would translate it I with, if I'm going to use that preposition, beth. Hundreds of ways, well, probably not hundreds, tons of ways you can translate it. Tons. It just used a lot. So, first thing I want to point out about the word is this word, ani, the word translated pains, can denote pain. But it denotes pain which one can experience because of being afflicted. If you're afflicted with something, you could be ani. I have postherpetic neuralgia. I have ani. Mark has ani. Probably Dwayne has ani in his knee. I can see every day. I can make that one rhyme for you, Dwayne. Ani in the knee. This pain, okay? It can mean that. That's you're experiencing pain because you're afflicted by something, by someone, and that's what all those verses do. Just examples of ani being used that way. And here's one. I'm just going to state one and kind of move along. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the ani, the affliction of my people are in Egypt. And I've heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And all of us are aware of what the people of Egypt went, or the people of Israel went through under Egyptian bondage. So you have no trouble understanding that these were people who were afflicted with lots and lots of pain. Two, the words ani, in my trouble, can also denote the pain which one inflicts on others. The pain which one inflicts on others. The Congress of the United States of America has afflicted much ani upon its people. They have inflicted us with $1.3 trillion worth of new debt. Ani. So you have, when you see that, okay, now I see a word that says, let's see, I am being afflicted or I am afflicted pain. And so then you have, and here's one for those. I think I put one there. Yeah. Therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. In this case, the taskmasters, slave drivers, are the ones doing the ani. So you, either way, so you got a context, you got to figure that out, and then you have another thing to figure out. And then you understand what the passage is saying. Until you answer those, until you tell me, is David being afflicted with pain, or is David afflicted with pain, and is the pain emotional or physical, you don't know what God is trying to say, what he has said. You have to understand what he means by the words that he's used, and sometimes it takes a little time. So, ani can refer to the pain or punishment resulting from affliction that can be physical pain, it can be mental, emotional, I just used the word emotional, or both of these simultaneously. Anybody who's lived pain very long knows that pain's not, even physical pain's not just physical pain, it gets to you. It grates on you, makes you a cranky old man. I'm beginning to think I'm more like Walter. What was his name? I liked him in that movie too. Walter Matthau. Yeah, Matthau. He's a good guy. I understand you now, Walter. I didn't get him when I watched his younger man, but you're on the right track. Here's an example. And here's the emotional pain. You can see the physical point, I hope, with the people of Israel. Thus, have I, and the have I that is speaking in the context that we're looking at is Jacob. Thus, have I, Jacob, been 20 years at thy is Laban, his brother, his uncle, at his mother's brother, at thy house. I have served thee 14 years for thy two daughters, 6 years for thy cattle. Now thou hast changed my wages 10 times, Genesis 31:42, except the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely thou hadst sent me away now empty. God hath sent my ani. Now there isn't anything that indicates that I can read through the life of Jacob that Laban ever afflicted Jacob physically. But he caused him a great deal of mental, emotional anguish and grief. Yes, and that's what he's talking about mental, emotional anguish. So the word can be used that way. So here's all the things I know about the word, and that just brings me here. Well, one more, I guess. Now he says this. Now behold, in my trouble, now behold, with great pains, I prepared for the house of the Lord. Now, that phrase has 5 possible explanations. Based on what those words can mean, there's 5 ways that this can be explained. And they are: 1. The words may be expressing that it was with the affliction that David inflicted on others in the wars he fought, by which he gained this great wealth. And this is we'll see next week, this is an enormous amount of wealth that David had gained, that he was contributing for the building of the temple. Well, where did this shepherd, and that's what he came from, he came from a poor family, where did this little shepherd boy from this poor family, who left his house with a paper sack of everything he owned, where did he gain this great wealth? Where did it come from? Well, it came from wars, okay? And those wars then led to taxes being paid to him. But it came from these great wars. And one reason they say, well, this is a strong possibility, is because what the theological word book of the Old Testament says concerning the primary meaning of the verb form that's related to the noun. The verb is hana, and the verb hana means to force. And his quote, the primary meaning of hana is to force or try to force, submission, and to punish or inflict pain upon. Well, when you're going into battle, sometimes I think our nation had lost sight of this after the Second World War, but the object of war is to defeat the enemy. That's his object. And that will require, usually, to force them into submission is usually not easy. But that's what David did. He sought to force people into submission, and by forcing those people into submission, he gained great wealth, as I'm going to show you, from those people. And so he maybe explained to Solomon, okay, this is how all this money you see, all of this, these assets you see accumulated, here's where they came from, Solomon. We read here from Numbers 24:24. It says, and the ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and shall afflict Asher, and afflict Eber, and he also shall perish forever. I do not like putting things up with, as you know, geographically, because this happened in a real place and time. This is not a very good map, but it's one of the few I could find. Kittim, actually called Kittim, you can see where Asher is, named after Assyria, named after the son of Asher. And Kittim is right here. We call it Beit-El Crete. So ships were going to come from here, they were going to come into the coast, and they were going to attack. And they were going to bring the people of Asher into submission. That's what they were going to do, and that's the intent here. and ship shall come from the coast of Katim, and shall afflict, shall force into submission Asher, and shall force into submission Eber, and he also shall perish forever. Numbers 24:24. Now, this is what David did. These are just a few. You could spend a long time on the wars of David, and I'm not going to do that, but you could. And David smote Moab and measured them with a line. The then that he's talking about, the battle is over, and again, there's a really different mindset, the way the ancients fought war, right, than the way Americans fight war. Other enemies, not so much like us. But battle was now over. He had won, so what he does, he takes these and tells you, he measures lines, he lays down the enemy soldiers after the battle is over, two lines, but even with two lines he measures to put to death, and with one line to keep alive. So there's lines of people, and they slaughtered one line, the other line they kept alive. It took them into captivity. And so the Moabites became the servants, slaves, better word, David's slaves, and brought gifts. How polite. Do you think you send gifts to Washington every April 15th? No, it's not a gift. It's a tax, okay? It's a pretty heavy tax. And that's the idea of the word here. And in later translations will use tribute. They brought tribute or taxes to David. How did David gain wealth? He gained wealth by defeating the enemy, taking, and I'll show you a place where he took a bunch of goods, and then they had to continue to pay taxes to him. I don't like places without showing them to you, so here we go. It says Moab, as you can see, here's Moab, which now part of this would be Jordan, to the east of the Dead Sea. So he captured Moab. The Moabites became slaves unto David, and those who were not killed allowed to live. Of the soldiers he took with him, the regular Moabite people left in their land, and every year money rolled into the coffers of David, year after year after year after year after year. Keep this in mind. Don't matter much till next week. David smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah, as he went to recover his border at the river Euphrates. Now that is one confusing sentence. And I do not have enough time. Didn't take enough time. Probably could have. Why is it confusing? Okay. First question is, who's the his? Pronouns a babysitter for a noun. Does it refer to Hadadezer? Does it refer to David? Not sure, because I didn't do the work with it. In the border, and by the way, it doesn't say the river Euphrates, nor does it say the. And that both of those things are significant. It just simply says the border at river. The reason it's important to take the thee out, anytime you see in the Old Testament the river, it does mean Euphrates, without exception. But there is no thee in the Hebrew, and there is no Euphrates. That's added later. So I'm not even sure which river that they're talking about. So I don't know. What I do know is David smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, and I know where Zobah is, and so do you. At least now you know where it is. You can see it here on the map that we have stuck up, way over here. And it is possible, I don't know how far to extend this kingdom, but you can't see the Euphrates coming up, but it does come up like this, and it does a branch to the west, and it runs up into this area. So it could be to the Euphrates, and be possible, because how far was the kingdom to go? All the way to the Euphrates River. But the point is, by war, by battle, he drove this guy all the way back up into Zobah, defeated him, and took control of the river, whichever river that was. And here's why I say it's possible. Because Exodus 23:31 tells us the boundaries of the land promised to Israel. And I don't think they've ever had all this boundaries. The entirety of the land, I cannot find that they've ever had all of it. And I will set, God will do this. God will do this. Trump won't do this, okay? The plan that he's coming up is not going to do this. The plan any president's coming up with is not going to do this. The Middle East plan has already been set. the boundaries for Israel is going to be have been set by God. I will set thy bounds from the Red Sea even unto the Sea of the Philistines, that would be the Mediterranean, and from the desert unto the river, now read Euphrates. Okay, that's the boundaries. Exodus 23:31, Genesis 15:8. Made clear that the river is Euphrates, tells me here. In the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. This, again, is not a very good map, but this is kind of a representation of what the promised land is. And are you dying? So you can see, never has Israel, even the expanded kingdom of David and Solomon, never had all of it. But they will. They will. That's the land promised to them, and that includes Gaza, okay, and that includes, and it's not the West Bank, it's Samaria, and that includes Samaria. Every time you hear the West Bank, Samaria, 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 just call it what it is. It includes all of it. It's been promised to the people of Israel by God, and God's pretty good about keeping his word. So my guess is he'll probably get all of it without any probably. Great. Definitely will be their land at his time. But here David is going through. So David smote Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he went to recover the border at the river Euphrates. And he did, and he recovered it. And then we note David took from him. This is what he did. It's different. When we defeated Germany and Japan, we didn't take a thing. We just put it all back in. That's what we do. We're different. I used to, when I was I got in trouble for this too. I did this in high school. I mean, if you've got any sense at all and you're a poor country, attack the United States. We'll rebuild you. Mr. Whaley was not happy. My favorite teacher, and Kim and I have become, we're friends. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, 20,000 footmen. David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but reserved of them for 100 chariots. So he took 100 chariots, 100 chariot horses, the way they went in. Chariots aren't all that valuable, really, in Palestine, because it's such a hilly country, unless you can get out into the plains to fight. Tough to use them. Then, and when the Syrians of Damascus came to aid Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David slew the Syrians, 22,000 men. And then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became slaves to David, and they brought taxes to David. And they kept sending them in, and in, and in, and in. Keep this in mind, year after year after year after year, they paid taxes. And the Lord preserved David wherever he went. His money's rolling in from these wars. Now, Syrian, since I haven't put it, there you go. You see Zobah, and you can see why the Syrians are going to come down to help. And he's getting right up close to us, the Syrians of Damascus. He took it over. Now they have all of this. And these people are paying taxes, tribute to David. Not only paying taxes, he took stuff from them too. David took the shields of gold that were on the servants, and we had 22,000 of them. And I don't know what these weighed. We did this a few weeks back. Remember when we looked at the shields that Solomon had? They were each had 3 pounds of gold each. Now I've got 66,000 pounds of gold if they're in that category. One battle, one place. And he took the shields of gold that were on the servants of Hadadezer. He brought them to Jerusalem. Begin to see, where is this? How did you get this wealth? It came from these wars. And from Bethah, and from Berathai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took very much bronze. Okay? So here. Couldn't find the other city, but there is Berathai up here, another town someplace near. He just took stuff out of them too. That's what you did. You know, to the victor went the spoils. They didn't worry about being politically correct when they fought wars. They worried about winning, just smashing the enemy and taking everything they could. And David did. And notice God was with him every place he went. And when Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had smitten all the host of Hadadezer, Hamath, let's find that one on our map, so we've got places for all these, and you can see where Hamath is related to Zobah, so you can see why these guys would have problems, territories adjoining each other. So when he finds out that David defeats his enemy, and this is what Toi does, then Toi sent Joram, his son, unto King David to greet him and to bless him, because he fought against Hadadezer and smitten him, for Hadadezer had wars with Toi. And Joram brought with him vessels of silver and vessels of gold and vessels of bronze. More items of wealth. Gold, silver, bronze. These were valuable items. Where did they come from? David collected them from other kings. He collected them as a result of his many battles. 2 Samuel 8, that was 10, there's 11 and 12. Which also, notice what David did with this. Which also King David did dedicate unto the Lord with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated of all the nations he subdued. All of them. Every nation he subdued, he took silver, gold, bronze, things of value at. David didn't put it in David's bank account. David set all of it aside. He was saving it because he had a goal in mind. His end goal was to build a temple. And so he began to put these things away. Of Syria, and of Moab, and of the children of Ammon, and of the Philistines, and of Amalek, and of the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rahab, king of Zobah. And move to 1 Chronicles 20, verse 2. Please keep this in mind, the weight of this one, because I will do something with weights next week, and I'm going to refer back to this. And David took the crown of their king from his head and found it weighed a talent of gold. Now, there are two possible weights for that, depending on whether you're using the talent of the temple, which you can compute by the shekel to be about 75 pounds, or whether you're using the king's talent, which was the kind of the common money used every day, which can be calculated. We did that a while back, remember, which is about half of the talent of the shekel. So that would make this weigh about 37.5 pounds. Now, if you're going to put a crown on your head, let me ask you, which would you prefer wearing? Yeah. I don't want to set my head to be, yeah, be picking me off the ground. I couldn't put it. I don't think I could put 75 pounds on my neck and have it sustain it. 37.5, it ain't enough. But whatever it was, that's a talent of gold. So at least 37.5 pounds from just one thing that he picked up here. And there were precious stones in it, and it was set up on David's head. And he brought also what? Very much spoil out of the city. 1 Chronicles 20, verse 2. And what did he do with very much spoil? He put it in, dedicated it for the building of the temple of the Lord. And so he gets his tribute from all of these places that we hear. The Philistines, he got it from there. He gets it over here from Hamath, from Zobah, from Ammon, Moab, Edom, all of this area. All paying taxes into David's coffers year after year after year. So he fights these wars, and this is how he gains this great wealth. And so when I look at 1 Chronicles 22, so now behold, you think about this. That's what I mean. Look, son, listen to me. And he's talking to his son. He's talking to Solomon, maybe 20, 21 years old. He's not an experienced, aged man at this point in life. Listen, son, in my trouble, with many afflictions, with great pains, have I prepared for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver, and bronze and iron beyond weight. For it is in abundance, timber, also in stone have I prepared, and thou mayest add to this. So you can look at this, and then I can say, The first two explanations possible, flowing from what I know about David's history, is that they're expressing this was the affliction that he inflicted upon others to gain his great wealth. Or, and for me it's more probably this way, I think he's trying to tell his son the price he paid. The words are expressing that it was the afflictions which were inflicted upon David. By God's grace, I've never had to serve in military combat. So I don't have a personal frame of reference that I can draw from the horror of what that is like. The price, the individual personal price that a man, and now today a woman, pays on the battlefield. I don't care if they don't get inflicted with, if they don't get a Purple Heart at all. Even if they're not inflicted, the emotional pain that you go through, the agony watching somebody you love, a fellow soldier, minister, your best, maybe somebody saved your life a couple of times, and all of a sudden you see his head go flying off. What kind of toll does it take on you? And the way they fought was a lot different than today. They weren't 100 yards apart shooting at each other. They were engaged in hand-to-hand, up close. You've seen the movies and the pictures, whacking each other's heads off, stabbing each other. And you watch your friends go down. Maybe you take a wound or two yourself. What kind of toll does that take upon a human being? What a price. And I think when he talks to Solomon, that's what he's talking about. I said, I paid this enormous price. And how much more disappointing that might have been too to him. Here I paid this enormous price of what war costs him. Look at me. And I don't get to do it. So again, these words, with great pains, ani, can denote the pain which one experiences because he's afflicted. Because of being afflicted. And I said to ask you to remember this. And here I'm back to it. Lord, remember David and all his afflictions. And then certainly that could cover the time from the time Saul sought to put David to death and going through all that period. And right up through all the wars and battles and everything that David had to go through. This great wealth didn't come easy. David wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. He didn't come from a family like the Kennedys, where one child to the next. I'm not picking on anybody. Hey, you got it. One child to the next. That's not how it came. I can't think of a more difficult way. I really can't, in my own mind, to gain wealth than to have to do it this way. How awful. How hard. That must have been. Remember his afflictions. Afflictions that he endured until he could find a house, a place for the Lord, a dwelling place for the Lord. So our word afflictions, and I want you to tell you something else about our word afflictions. You can read in English forever, and you're never going to know this. People ask, why do you bother messing around with all that, you know, language junk? You know, you need to tell people what's going on. No, it's not just junk. You see, Hanan, as it's used here in our passage in 1 Chronicles 22:14, is a Puel stem. Okay? Hebrew thinks about action as either active or passive, just like we do in English. But there's different kinds of active action, and there's different kinds of passive action. This Puel stem is used here. I'm going to put, here's a simple. The cal stem, well, this is passive. Cal's active. The nifil stem is a simple passive stem. Now, when I took Hebrew, I used Dr. Weingreen's book. I have a better illustration I'd share with him today, but this is the book that I used. And so when he tried to illustrate to me and to his students, okay, what's the difference between a nifil stem? Well, that's simple passive. He used the word ahar. Ahar means to break. or broke in past tense, or in the passive voice. So putting that into a sentence with the man, the nifil or simple stem says he was broken. But if you're going to put it in the PL stem, you have to make the action tensive. You just can't simply say it was broken. You have to, in the way he did that, and I think it does it, he was smashed. Okay? He was shattered. Well, that's a lot more intense than broken. I like the word I kill in Hebrew. That's one I use. The simple passive stem in Hebrew is I was killed. Okay? Put that same stem in the puel, I was slaughtered. You get a sense of the feel of what that does to a word. And so when you take the word afflictions, you've got to do something with that word. You've got to somehow try and get that intensive aspect of the stem out. And so I did something like this. You can pick your own. In my torments, in my vexations, in my distresses, and of all these, I personally like torments first. In my torments, I have prepared for the house of the Lord. That's how all of this wealth came, by going through all these torments, all these vexations. Now here, this is just a quote from, as you can see, my ICC, isn't that who it is? Yeah, this is John Lang's the International Critical Commentary. He points this out about the word, and I appreciate him doing that, because I didn't see it the first couple times going through. I went back then and said, okay, I see where you're coming from. He says this word can denote troubles which attend efforts that are long without result. Okay, let's start. Now, we're going to apply that to David? Absolutely. His efforts were for, he was trying to get money, wealth together for what? To build the temple. And so it just took a long time. He didn't have one battle and took over the land. He was, as we looked at from Deuteronomy a few weeks back, he was engaged in all these battles, had to be, because God said, I won't pick out a place, I won't tell you where I want the place to be until there's peace in the land. So he goes over this long, extended period of time engaging in wars, subduing the enemies of Israel so that peace can be gained, and he never wearied. He continued. This is what this man went through. This is why I call it a personal price that he paid. Incredible. It's incredible. Thou knowest that David, my father, this is his son Solomon, he's writing a letter to Hiram of Tyre. Thou knowest how that David, my father, could not build an house unto the name of the Lord his God. Because why? Because of the wars. Because of the wars. Because he was constantly involved in these battles, engaged in campaigns that were causing him great torment, great vexation, great distresses, great pains. He paid a real price, which were about him on every side, and the Lord put them on the soles of his feet, 1 Kings 5:3. This is something I found from the Journal of American Medicine. So, as I told you, I've not been in war, nothing about it. Although we're hearing a lot more today about this as we see men coming back. 62% of respondents, and he's talking, this has to deal with people who are involved in the war in Afghanistan, specifically. 62% of the respondents reported experiencing at least 4 trauma events during the previous 10 years. That's a trauma event every 2.5 years. Every 2.5 years, men, 62%, more than half of the men, women, involved in the fight in Afghanistan, every 2.5 years go through some kind of trauma event. Symptoms of depression were found in 67.7%. That's more than 2/3. Of those people who were engaged in I don't know what aspect of the war they were engaged in Afghanistan. I don't know, they didn't tell me if they were battle combatants or not. 67 plus percent. Symptoms of anxiety,
72.2. It's nearly three-fourths of them.
Post-traumatic distress disorder, 42%.
You tell me that being involved in warfare, I can't
even imagine what it's like to have to take the life of another man or woman, even though that person's an enemy.
I'm a human being.
I've got all these complex things that make me up, just like you do. But I can't imagine that being easy. And the emotional price that people have to pay, thank God there are men and women who have paid that price. That's why I'm standing here today free. No worries. Comfortable. Well, David went through that. So he says, now behold, and now read out of that. In my troubles, in my afflictions. Read out of that the things we've been looking at I prepared for the house of the Lord. And this is how I got all of this. Let me give you a third possible meaning. I gotta hurry. A third possible meaning. The words can also denote frustration, distress, disappointment. That can denote frustration, the word ani, frustration, distress, disappointment. And in the context, and I've got to read that. If I got to read something out, well, then if it's that sense, and it's the distress, it's the frustration, the disappointment he experienced, not being able to fulfill his heart's desire. Man, this is number one on my bucket list, and I don't need to do it. And I could. I've got everything I need. And I have paid the price to get every single thing I need to do this, and I can't. Could he be disappointed? Absolutely. Here is what this lexicon reads and tells us about the word in a place where you can see this sense from. This is BD&B, Brown, Rivers, and Briggs. It's a standard Hebrew lexicon. Second meaning, and then he uses it, he gives it this very free phrase. This is the second meaning for ani, but then he quotes beh ani. This is the preposition in front of, and then he says, here's how you translate it. In spite of my frustration. That is a possible meaning. Maybe that's what he was trying to say to his son. Is possible. And now behold in my troubles. Behold in my frustrations, my disappointments, have I prepared for the house of the Lord. Or, now behold, with great pains I have prepared for the house of the Lord. The word can also have the sense of doing something with painstaking care. It can have that sense. With painstaking care. So that he took great pains, in that sense we would understand that. He took great pains to get everything ready to prepare for the temple. Those are four of the possible explanations. I'm more inclined to think maybe it could be all of them. I certainly would tie it to thoughts 2, 3, and 4. Again, we're not just single things. We're complex. We really are. And the things that go inside of us, you sometimes are just not all cut and dry. If you said, okay, you have to pick one and only one, I would pick the second one. But I'm not sure the thought isn't a combination of 2, 3, and 4. I'm going to give you a final comment on these words. I with misery, I in misery, I with great pains, I having taken great pains, I have in much trouble, I in torments, I in vexations, I in distresses, I with frustrations. Every one of those translations are legitimate translations in that context. You're just going to have to pray about it if you want and decide for yourself which is right. Again, my responsibility is to show you what's there. And I've told you, I'll be happy to tell you the position I hold. Could I be wrong? Sure I could. But I really believe he's talking about the things he went through. Mentally, emotionally, physically, all the scars that were left on him, not just on the outside but on the inside, through all the battles that he fought. But I can take, I don't care which one of these translations I use, I can still see one common denominator in all of that. All of it. And the common single thought is this.
They communicate a single thought. They're just coming at it from different directions. If you've ever been a witness to an accident, maybe there's been an accident, three or four people have seen what's happened. You ever watch on TV and something, you know, major has happened, and they'll go around and they'll get, you know, this. Well, tell me what you saw. Well, one person will say one thing, another person will say something else, maybe different, and then somebody else something different. But they're all telling you the same thing, one way or the other. You're still getting the same thing. And there is a single thought here, and I hold to this position that the single thought is David's zeal required him to pay the price of self-sacrifice. That's what it required. It required David to pay the price of self-sacrifice. That's the issue here. And there's certainly truth we ought to be able to learn from that ourselves. David's zeal demonstrates that genuine biblical zeal, real zeal, as we have talked about and defined, and we defined it something like this, that real zeal is an intently serious, nothing flippant about it at all, serious desire on the part of the believer to live his life, her life, eagerly live our lives in open identification with the Lord Jesus Christ. Because we believe He's God, the Son. We want to reveal our passionate commitment to Jesus by emulating His life. And specifically, emulating His life by seeking to live in accordance with the Word. I can say this to you. You know, you can come to church every Sunday, and nobody's going to bother you or say much about you coming to church every Sunday. And they might poke a little fun, think, well, what a waste of time. They're not going to say much. You go out and you live every day, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you live every day presenting your bodies a living sacrifice unto God, then you watch what people say about you. Be real different. It'll be very different. So it tells me that, look, if I'm going to really be zealous for the Lord as is set forth in the Scripture, you know, then I better be prepared to pay a price. It's just, that's the reality, and there's no need to hide it or lie about it. That's the reality. David's zeal demonstrates genuine biblical zeal, that is what I've now called a zeal, the real deal, as you can see, can require sacrifice. Example, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They demonstrated zeal. Well, they pay a sacrifice. We talk about dry heat. Well, they knew dry heat. Eh? And what about Daniel? Yeah. He demonstrated genuine zeal for God. Pay a price? You want to spend a night with a lion? Not me. But he did. He did. The apostles. All of them. All of them. If you want to read these passages, I suggest you give them this thing. If you want to read about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, read Daniel chapter 3. You want to read about Daniel's price, read Daniel chapter 6. The apostles, simple places, Acts 4, Acts 5. Just keep reading the book of Acts. Read Corinthians. Stephen? Yeah. He manifested real zeal for the Lord. It cost him his life. Epaphroditus? You bet. He was willing to go do it, something in Rome that a lot of believers were scared to death to do. Identify himself with the Apostle Paul. Well, why would you be frightened? Because Paul was in prison for what? His faith. And if I identify myself with him, could I wind up here? Very well could have. How about all the unnamed Hebrew believers? Hebrews chapter 10. They paid a price for identification with Christ. All the believers that Peter writes about in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia Minor, Bithynia, all these were believers who paid a price. Believers at Smyrna. I mean, you can do this for a long time. And this kind of teaching, when you talk today about self-sacrifice, it's not wanted in America. Okay, it really isn't. this article is me, me, me. Okay, America's narcissism epidemic appeared a couple of years ago. I should know and I don't. On it today, online. And it, this was, and I'm just going to quote what this, I'm sorry I don't have the date. It's not been that many years ago. It really, October of 16. Okay, there you go. In data from 37,000 college students, narcissistic personality traits rose just as fast as obesity. Now, we're calling obesity a national crisis in this country. You know, we got, you know, Gestapo Mayor de Blasio saying you can only have this much Coke because you're getting too fat in New York. You know, it's, you know, whatever they are. But because it is a problem. But this is rising just as fast. Okay? From the 1980s to the present. And this surprised me. This shift especially pronounced for women. I'm just reading the article. The rise of narcissism is accelerating, with scores rising faster in the 2000s than in previous decades. By 2006, one out of four college students agreed with the majority of the items on the standard measure narcissistic traits. 25% of college students said, yes, these are good things, you ought to have them. 25%. And it hasn't escaped the church either, by any stretch at all. Thomas Reeves, who is a historian, that's his basic thing, University of Wisconsin, Parkville or something like that. It's not Parkside, University of Wisconsin, Parkside. Something he wrote. He says, Christianity in modern America is in large part innocuous. It's true. It tends to be easy, upbeat, convenient, compatible. It doesn't require self-sacrifice. Well, Christianity in America may not require self-sacrifice, but biblical Christianity does. Biblical Christianity does. It requires self-sacrifice. We've heard, and I caught a part of this morning while I was doing dishes in the kitchen making my coffee. But again, I have a lot of respect for John McCain. But I heard him in a speech that he gave, and I can only paraphrase it. But in that speech, he was talking about the service he has given and all that he has been through, you know, from his war days all the way through his time in the Senate. And he said that he talked about the self-sacrifice. And he said, I cannot think of anything, and this is a paraphrase, more worthy of sacrifice than this. Well, I could instantly. Within a second. And it's a sacrifice that every one of us can make. I mean, my mind went back, and if I'd been standing there, I'm going to blurt it out. Well, here, this is. What more could you do? Well, here's what more that you could do. What you could do is to present your bodies a living sacrifice. Every single day we can do that. We can do that. That's far more important in the scheme of eternity than the sacrifice. And he made a sacrifice. Than the sacrifices made by John McCain. Far more. Because as we present our bodies as living sacrifices unto the Lord, which is our, what did it say in King James? Whatever says this wrong. I'll quote it to you correctly. To present our bodies a living sacrifice unto the Lord, which is our service, logikos, flowing from rational, reasonable, spiritual thinking. Because when we do that, then people have a chance to get saved. And it's far more important that one person, just one person, escapes eternal damnation than all of the things our senator has done for our state and for our country, and he has done much. Now, there is something far more important. And how can we? I don't know what happened to my slide. I had some other slides that went here and they went away. Here. You asked Peter if he didn't. Here, boy, quick. As I thought about this, what came into my head was Matthew. Ask me why. I just had weird thoughts, I know. But I'm standing by my head thinking about sacrificing. Here I'm thinking about Matthew. Matthew's living a good life. Okay? Really is. Sit back in the tax office. He's raking in the money. Oh, he had to put up with some Israelites who didn't like it. On you, I don't care. Hey, you see me? No, I've got designer tunics. I don't wear that trash you guys wear. Yeah. My sandals are from Jordan. Yeah, I got the best of everything. He was making money hand over fist as a tax collector. He was living a great life. And this guy walks along and says, "Follow me." He had to make a decision. And he said, "Just leave it all. He left it all behind." And he got up and he followed Jesus. Now I submit to you, that's making a sacrifice. Okay? That's a sacrifice. You come by my house and say, "Hey, open the door, follow me." And you just walk away from everything. Matthew did that. It's a sacrifice. Peter considered it, what they did, a sacrifice. Then Peter said, "Whoa, look, we've left everything. We've left it all. And we followed you." Ah, but is it really a sacrifice? Listen to Jesus' response. "Verily I say unto you, there is no man that has left house, or parents, or brethren, or wife, or children, for the kingdom of God's sake, who shall not receive manifold more in this present time, in the age to come, everlasting life." So how big a sacrifice did Matthew really make? How about Peter? And then how can any believer, and we're on a little different place than they are at that point, how can any believer think that you're making a sacrifice? How? When we contemplate the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made, how can we think, well, we don't sacrifice by dying, we sacrifice by living for Christ. That's the sacrifice that God asks us to make. That's the sacrifice. So as you continue to hear things about sacrifice for probably a week or so, I want you to think about that sacrifice right there. The sacrifice of God for us. And then think about, in light of that sacrifice, what about me? What about me? And I had to ask myself this question. I've been a believer a long, long time. I basically haven't had to sacrifice anything. I really haven't. The biggest sacrifice I've had to make, I left my home. I left my family. And exactly what Jesus said happened. And I've gained 100-fold more. 100-fold more. People that really are my family. People like you. People in Christ. So I'm going to leave you with the same image I had starting this morning. What about me? What about me?